I'm Allison Kulo.
And I'm Doug Wells. Welcome to Mound Money on KPCW.
American Homes for Rent invests in single-family communities and provides single-family rental housing. American Homes for Rent has made significant investments in Summit County, and I recently saw that they're developing quite a few single-family homes in the Silver Creek Village Center. David Howard, Executive Director of the National Rental Home Council, joins us this morning to discuss the impacts of single-family rentals on housing markets, the community need they meet, and the changes from institutional investors entering the marketplace. David, thank you for joining us on Mountain Money.
I'm happy to be here this morning. I just wish I were there with you in person. You're actually in one of my favorite parts of the country.
Well, I'm glad to hear. Yeah, unfortunately, we don't include the stipend for you to make your way out this way. But happy to have you over the airwaves. Let's begin with the National Rental Home Council. How long has the organization existed? Why was it started? And what is its main purpose?
The National Rental Home Council was formed in 2014, so relatively recently in terms of trade associations. We represent the single family rental home industry. We're based here in Washington, D.C., which is where I'm calling in from this morning. The business of renting single family homes has been around literally for as long as anyone can remember. But it's only been over the past 10 to 20 years that there has been this interest in putting together an industry organization to represent the industry, all owners in the industry, from large corporations to individual owners, the quote mom and pops, who really control most of the market for single family rental homes. And so as the trade association that represents the single family rental home industry, we work with media. An example of that obviously would be the call this morning with you. We spend a lot of time here in Washington, D.C., working with policymakers and legislators to make sure that they understand what the industry is all about and what the companies and individuals in the space are working to accomplish.
And give our audience an example of the size of that market. What percent of single-family homes are rental units versus owned by the person living in them?
So there are about 23 million single-family rental homes in the United States, which represents about half of all the rental housing in the country. And I like to start with that statistic because I think when people think about rental housing, they tend to think about apartments in Salt Lake City, apartments in San Francisco, New York City, Chicago, et cetera. But again, the reality is half of the rental housing in the United States is actually classified as single family rental housing. So again, of the 44, 45 million-ish total units of rental housing, about half of those, 23 million or so, are actually classified as single family rental homes.
Now, single family rentals are an important part of the housing ecosystem. Can you give us an understanding of what is the housing ecosystem?
So I mentioned there are roughly 45 million rental housing units in the country. There are approximately 142, 143 million total housing units. That is owner-occupied housing, it's rental housing, and it's also vacant housing. And these are classifications and data points that come from the U.S. Census Bureau. They've got a lot of really good data on their website that tracks the number of housing units, both, again, owner-occupied and rental housing. When I talk about the fact that single-family rental housing is an important part of the housing ecosystem, again, what I'm really referring to is the fact that single-family rental housing has existed in this country for as long as anyone can remember, and it fills a really important part of the housing market. More and more people today are renting by choice rather than by necessity. There are affordability challenges. A lot of people are choosing to relocate to new markets. And so single family rental homes provide flexibility, both in terms of where someone wants to live, how they want to live, what they can afford to pay for their housing needs. All of that really is addressed with the benefits that come from single family rental housing.
Yeah, and let's talk about the rental rates. Do the single family rentals, does the institutionalization of that industry, how does that impact housing supply, prices, and the rental rates people are paying?
I'm not sure that the institutionalization of the single family rental housing market really has much or anything to do with things like rental rates or the availability of housing. And the reason for that is because institutions, quote unquote, really account for a very small share of the overall single family rental housing and an even smaller share of the total rental housing universe. To put that in perspective, again, of the 23 million or so single family rental homes in this country, only about 1.5 to 2% are owned by large companies. Most of the large corporate owners of single family rental homes are members of the National Rental Home Council. And so that's data that we track pretty closely. Again, of the 23 million single family rental homes, only about 300,000 or so are owned by large companies. The vast majority, 90%+ of the single family rental homes in the United States are actually owned by individuals with five or fewer properties.
That's right where I was going to go. I wanted to know what that other, as you've referred to as mom and pop ownership, looks like. What types of things had gotten these owners into the single family rental business, and what do they care about?
Well, a lot of individual owners, I should say, come into the single family rental home space, frankly, by accident or through inheritance. Somebody will own a home that has been in their family for 20 or 30 years, and they will choose to rent that home out. Somebody will purchase a home with a friend from college and rent that home out as an investment over time. There's an interesting issue around this term investor in the single family rental home space that gets a lot of attention. We talked earlier about the institutionalization of the market. There are investors in single family rental housing. Everybody's familiar with folks who buy homes with the intent to flip those homes, folks who buy homes with the intent to hold those homes just for a short period of time. Those are what I would call investors in single family rental homes. Most owners in the market are in fact in the space for the long term. We know that larger companies, for example, tend to own their homes for 12+ years. And so it's interesting with the institutions who have come into the space, they're really in the business of providing long-term stabilized rental housing. Again, there is some short-term investing in this space, which you tend to see in the flipping market and with some individuals who, again, come into the market, purchase homes with the intent to hold them and sell them for a very short period of time. But again, most owners in the single-family rental home space tend to hold their properties for extended periods of time.
And I'm curious, you know, everything's done on our phones now. How has technology in the last 5 or 7 years impacted the single family home rental market?
Well, I will tell you that's a space where the larger companies, the institutions, are coming in and really moving the industry forward. It's possible now, as a housing consumer to rent a single family home without ever meeting with the owner of that home. What I mean by that is it's now possible to search for homes. Everybody, I think, is familiar with that. Search for homes online, on your smartphone, on your desktop computer. But you can also now engage in self-showings, virtual tours of homes completely online. You can also complete and submit an application to rent a home completely online. If you do want to go visit a home in person, you can do that without interfacing with a property management professional or the owner. A lot of homes now that are owned by institutions have keyless entry systems. And again, programs that will allow you as a potential renter to visit the home with a special code that is provided so that you can get into the home and check it out. So essentially, the entire experience of renting a home can take place without having to interact with the owner of the property face to face, which is something that's very different today than it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And all of that is made possible through technology, which really has just come online over the past, say, 5 to 10 years. And it's technology that is constantly improving. So my guess is 5 years from now, 10 years from now, the technology will be even more powerful and will enable residents and owners to interact in very different ways, certainly ways for the better. I mentioned that a lot of this technology is being driven by institutional owners. What's interesting about the single family rental home market is it's often the case that larger owners in the space will be the first movers in terms of technology adoption. They'll be the first ones to bring technologies onto the platform, and then over time usage of the various technologies will seep out through the rest of the industry to a point where you'll start to see some of the smaller owners and even some of the individual owners using the same kinds of technologies that the larger companies in the space are using.
So multifamily housing went through institutionalization back in the 1980s and 90s. Is it purely because of technology that we're seeing this in the single family home rental market?
I think you're seeing, well, let me say this. The reality is institutions have been an important part of the American housing market for decades, whether as investors in mortgages tied to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, investors in publicly traded home builder companies, or investors, to your point, in the multifamily market, to a point where today institutions own over half of all apartment units in the United States. And so I think what we're seeing is institutions have realized they can bring some of the same efficiencies and practices that have benefited these other housing sectors to the market for single family rental homes. And by doing so, they can create a better experience for the renting public.
Yeah, let me build on Allison's question, because it's interesting that the apartment industry has been 50% owned for a while by institutions. And it's just now where they're investing in single family homes. What were the factors outside of technology that we talked about that allows them to do that now, where maybe 50 years ago it would have been much more difficult?
Well, I will tell you, real estate, whether it's multifamily real estate, single family owner occupied real estate, or single family rental housing, is a business that depends on liquidity. And institutions are real in the housing space, are able to bring liquidity and capital to the, in this case, single family rental housing market in the same fashion they did with, again, some of these other housing sectors, in a way that makes single family rental housing more efficient, in a way that provides for a more consistent resident experience across markets, whether we're talking about the East Coast, the West Coast, the interior part of the country, what have you. The business of rental housing over time has also become much more complicated in terms of, and complex in terms of developing new homes. Many institutions are now transitioning away from the purchasing of homes for rental purposes toward the building of single-family homes for renting. So it's called build for rent, where, again, you have institutions that are building communities of homes expressly for the purpose of rental. That is all very complicated and time-consuming. And institutions, in many cases, are better able to engage in the kinds of activities that make real estate development possible.
One thing I want to talk about is the integration of single-family home rentals within communities with homeowners. A lot of times, you know, people look down on those who rent or rental properties thinking that they're not going to be as well taken care of. You know, the owner's not on site, the renter doesn't own it, so they may, you know, not care how they interact with the neighbors or how they treat the property. You know, is this, are these statements true?
I would say that statements of that sort are generalizations that typically don't reflect what is actually happening in those neighborhoods and communities. We've all lived in neighborhoods where there is someone on the street who doesn't keep their house up to the same level of standards that the rest of the residents in that community would appreciate. The folks who do that could just as easily be a homeowner as they can be a renter. I personally have had many experiences where homeowners in certain communities are often just as guilty as a renting family might be in terms of not cutting the grass or keeping the home up, again, to the kinds of standards that the neighborhood expects. So I tend to discount general statements that renters don't have the same kinds of incentives to keep their homes up to the same sorts of livability standards as homeowners. First of all, second of all, certainly most of our members have a vested interest in making sure that the properties they own are kept up to those same kinds of standards that are prevalent in the rest of the community. In other words, whether you're an institutional owner or an individual owner, you need to make sure that the house is well maintained, the house is well cared for, and that you don't see the kinds of things that you're referring to. Again, grass not being cut, landscaping not being taken care of, exterior and interior aspects of the home not being taken care of. It's always in the best interest of the homeowner, again, whether that's an institution or an individual, to make sure that that house is being taken care of. Really for two reasons. First, you want to make sure that the resident in your home is well cared for. That's the lowest common denominator. You always want whoever is in your home to have the best resident experience possible. And to do that, you've got to make sure that the home is, again, well maintained and well cared for. But the other thing is you want to make sure that you're able to continue to rent that home after the current resident leaves. In other words, this is very much a long-term business. Leases are typically 12 plus months. We know from data that we have, most residents tend to stay in a single-family rental home for 2 to 4 years before they leave to go somewhere else. As the homeowner, you're going to need to rent that home once that resident leaves. And to be able to do that, you have to make sure that it's well cared for and well maintained. And so again, you know, the generalization that renters don't keep their properties up to the same level, again, is something that I discount. And again, speaking from personal experience, I've been a renter of a single family rental home, and I can tell you on most Saturdays I was out there cutting the grass or trimming the bushes or whatever needed to be done around the house.
Yeah, good for you. We've all been in that situation. And let's give that point and say, I agree with you. I think you're just as likely as not likely. But there is one thing that a renter faces that an owner doesn't face, and that is not knowing what their costs are going to be at the end of their lease, right? If you own, you've got hopefully a fixed rate mortgage, you know what your interest rate's going to be, you have an idea on property tax. But as a renter, it's a little scary because you don't know what the landlord's going to raise your rent to. I'm curious, as an industry association, I'm sure you have these numbers, what was the nationwide rental increase over the last, you know, calendar year 2020 versus 2021? And which two or three states had the highest rental rate increase?
So I don't have the information for states with the highest rental rate increases, but what I can tell you is in terms of the nationwide rates of rental increase, that is something that we track. It's something we track on a quarterly basis. And what I can share with you is as of the most recent quarter for which we have data, which would have been the end of the first quarter 2022, rents for single family rental homes increased about 10%, just over 10%. According to the data that we generate, we also track apartment rents, home price appreciation. So to put it all in perspective, again, based on our data, single family rental home owners increased their rental rates by about 10% year over year as of the end of the first quarter 2022. Apartment rents during that time increased about 14%, and home price appreciation increased by over 20%. Interestingly, again, in terms of the 10% increase for single family rental homes, we're living in an environment where the cost of living is increasing on an annual basis by 8%, 9%. CPI data came out last week showing that prices have increased 8.5%. So, yes, it is true that rents for both single family rental homes and apartments have been increasing anywhere from 10 to 15%. We're living in an inflationary environment where the cost of living is increasing at a fairly expansive rate. And so I always like to point that out. You know, we're also, in terms of single family rental homes, we're also living in an environment, excuse the pun, where there are significant supply constraints in the housing market. There just aren't enough homes, either owner-occupied or rental, to meet the demand that's out there for single-family homes. And so I probably should never say never, but it's really never going to be the case that an owner of single-family rental homes can set the price for their rental increases in isolation. Virtually every case, the market dictates what the rental rates are going to be, and the market dictates those rates based on things like the supply of homes, the demand for homes, both macro and micro kinds of issues. So we're just living in a period of time where in an inflationary environment, in an environment where, again, we're facing unprecedented supply constraints on housing, both the cost of existing housing in the term of home price appreciation and the cost of rental housing is going to increase.
Okay, well, great. I will point out that inflation is largely, two of the biggest components in that is fuel and rental costs. So it's a bit of a circular situation where inflation is high, but part of that's driven by rental rates. But great conversation, lots of wonderful knowledge. We've been speaking with David Howard. He is the executive director of the National Rental Home Council. David, thank you for joining us. The Big Gear Show took place in Park City August 2nd through the 3rd. This event is Utah and the outdoor industry's most evolved trade show yet. The Big Gear Show was only open to retailers, media, and exhibitors, and was the place where well-known and innovative companies in the outdoor cycling and paddle sports industry provided introductions and demos of their new gear. Joining us this morning to tell us what all went on is Kenji Haratuninia, and he is the director of the Big Gear Show. Kenji, welcome to Mound Money.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So tell us what the Big Gear Show is and how it got started.
Sure. Well, the Big Gear Show is a new concept and trade show design, and it really at every turn, what we do is we bring together the elements of cycling, paddle sports, outdoor, which includes climbing and camping and hiking and trail running, and other relevant aspects like overlanding and road biking, e-bikes, and that kind of stuff. So we bring those categories together and bring together the retailers who sell that gear, particularly the specialty retailers, so the small mom-and-pop shops and the multi-store teams that are owned by people. And we bring them together for several days of gear review, looking forward to, in this case, 2023 gear. So it's a preview on products that are going to roll out next year.
Kenji, we're just having a little bit of trouble hearing you. If I may, if you're on speaker, if you could maybe turn that off, that may be where we're having some issues. Actually, not really.
Sorry.
That's all right. Let's keep going.
Okay, hopefully it'll get better as we go. So, yes, this is a show for the gear that gets people outdoors. And really, we're catching the wave of this participation increase of outdoor recreation across the spectrum, and really focusing on more of the products to get people outdoors. And I think the hard goods, the footwear, the technical apparel, and accessories that people use. So less emphasis on the lifestyle products, more emphasis on the gear.
So the people that are attending the gear show, they were able to demo that gear. What products were big hits? What did you see people either going back to try again or maybe long lines?
Well, some of the hottest categories at the show are definitely e-bikes and generally powered products. So whether it's portable power, like solar and battery banks, or electronic bikes, even paddle sports products like stand-up paddle boards and kayaks that are using small motors now. So that's a very hot category, any integration of technology and outdoor recreation is a very hot category. Other categories like running gear, trail running shoes, trail running products, like lightweight vests and hydration products are very popular. Let's see what else. Old back and carrier products. We have all the rack brands, so the Yakima, Thule, Quad, all the different ways to carry your gear in and on your vehicle. And protective gear, I would also say. Helmets, innovations in the technology for safety products that are lighter and more comfortable to wear, but also protective.
Kenji, was there, outside of the electrification of outdoor gear, was there any other themes that you see developing that maybe we don't know about, but we're going to see in the coming years?
Well, I think a little bit behind the scenes, there's been this disruption in supply chain that many people have heard about. This has certainly played out in the outdoor industry as well. So I think that was one of the big themes, was what does 2023 look like? How are we going to get product? How are we going to get it? It's a little bit of a different answer depending on what sector you're from. So that was kind of an underlying theme. The over-the-top theme, though, was certainly to encourage people to keep getting outdoors. There are benefits that I think have been aired just in the past few years for people getting outdoors, not just because of the pandemic, but because, you know, this is a stressful time, and this is one of the greatest coping mechanisms for people across the country. And so that, I would say, is the third thing, is the impact that more visitation has on public lands, on private parks, on state parks, and other places where we recreate have all seen pretty significant increases in visitation. So the impact that comes with that was a big discussion at the show, and the American Alpine Club and Access Fund and others hosted some of the discussions around that topic.
Kenji, let me follow up on that. You mentioned the pandemic and it introducing people, some people, to more of the physical and mental health benefits. People are getting out more now for vacation. Did the industry see any dip from the peak of COVID, or are the numbers still going up and to the right for demand?
Good question. I think that most of the data that we have access to is somewhat backward looking, you know, from a year ago or 6 months ago. It looks like the demand is still high. So, and that kind of plays itself out in the marketplace, where products are still hard to get. There's more demand than supply. So there's a pent up supply challenge there. I think looking into the future, people are somewhat concerned about the economy and, what it will look like, what their investments will look like. And when that happens, I've been in the industry for over 30 years. I've been through several kind of recession or bigger economic events. And there is this kind of back to nature, or just simplifying, or maybe close to home staycation movement that we see happening again, too. So I think that the anticipation is the demand will stay strong. It's a little bit fuzzy looking at 2023, whether it will stay as strong. I mean, most categories have in the past 2 years experienced double-digit growth consistently. So I think that's one of the reasons why buyers and companies and interested organizations of the industry want to get together, is because they want to collaborate and feel like they're part of something moving forward, and need to have some feeling of cohesiveness going into next year.
One of the things you said that had, I guess, high interest is really electrification or motorization, especially in paddle sports. Is that, really to help broaden the demographic of people who then use this? I mean, it allows people who are, getting older to be able to continue to do those sports, or maybe some people who are not as athletic. Is that the reason behind it?
Absolutely, yes. Access is increased when you have more options to power train your product, and whether that's an e-bike or a stand-up board. If you're stand-up paddling out in the harbor and the wind is up, it's very hard to challenge that wind if you're trying to move against it. So having an assist is very similar to an e-bike, or if you're going up a big hill and you just don't have the physical power to do that, it really makes a big difference. It expands the range of people who can use and get outdoors on those products. So, yes.
As somebody that's not getting younger, I appreciate that, but I also understand the controversy on the trails, and sounds like soon to be on the lakes as well. But I want to talk about, I have a electric skateboard, and unfortunately there were a whole bunch of low-cost electric balance boards and skateboards that came out and were causing fires, and it really gave that whole electric skateboard industry a bad name. Do you think the industry's learned from that? And give us your thoughts on the quality of the batteries so we don't experience that over again.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think one of the things that's unique about the Gear Show is we vet every company really carefully, both on the exhibitor side and on the attendee side. And so we look for companies with somewhat of a track record, a commitment to quality, and we do invite those in, leaders in that part of the industry like Goal Zero, newcomers like Pale Blue Earth, These are companies that are dedicated to really build, not just building quality product, but having a relationship with its retailers. And I think that is an important element. You know, as you said, some of the lower cost, kind of quick to market, not really service oriented, and unsure about the quality aspect. Those are very high risk purchases for retailers, not just because the product might not sell, but it might actually, you know, be a boomerang of negative PR or worse. So it's important for store organizers today to really look at who the companies are and bring the best of to the retailers so that they can have some confidence in that. Just to comment briefly, I think it is a very fast developing category when it comes to outdoor recreation, powered products, you know, battery banks, and it's not only in outdoor but also in electric cars and other products. You know, I live in the city and I see these scooters zooming around, and like there's 10 different, you know, brands that most of them I had not heard of. And so it's still an industry sector that's in flux. In on the trail, actually, you know, that part of it is also being innovated very quickly, and that is how do resorts, how do trail managers, public lands managers kind of manage this e-bike category? Do they have separate trails? Do they include them with mountain bikes? Are there specific rules and regulations around which kind of e-bikes? There's a lot of innovation and change in that part of the market.
I want to talk a bit about then the business of an expo. You know, running an expo, some of the things that you just talked about as far as, you know, legitimate manufacturers, you know, who you're bringing, you know, to those, in front of those retailers. How does that process work? And then as well, how do you know if you've had a successful show?
Great question, Allison. You know, it's a very different kind of business I've learned. I've been doing this over 20 years now, and it's an interesting service to kind of two major audiences, and then media would be an important third, and that is you're bringing in exhibitors, and they're asking, well, who's coming, you know, and then the retailers, they say, hey, you want to come, and they say, well, who's showing, and so you've got to kind of have this two-sided outreach effort that brings people together kind of in a logical sequence over the course of a year or so to build an event like this. So it requires a lot of trust and faith in the show organizers. And so it's hard. It's not rocket science, as I like to say, but it is a thousand little details that have to come together to make an event like this go off. And typically, in the show or events business like this, you've got to do it 2-3-4 times before you really put a flywheel catches and you've got a viable business platform. So we felt like last year, you know, during the heart of the pandemic, it was kind of loony to even try this, but we did, such as our madness. And then this year really was more of the proof of concept. People believed in it. It came in bigger numbers. And so we feel like we've got a going concern. But really the key to this is adapting, especially today, adapting to the needs of the market, which are very quickly changing. You know, this is kind of the reason for it.
It's an incredibly complex time, right? Not knowing until a couple weeks whether, you know, you're going to be able to put this, actually have it go forward. Now, I'm curious, there's a big giant in the industry in the event space, the Outdoor Retailer Show, which I understand is returning to Salt Lake City sometime soon. What was the niche? What was different about your show that you said there's room for both to thrive?
Well, there's a fair number of differences, and the location of the show is probably the least relevant to kind of the marketplace. The timing of it is very important. For example, and I can speak fairly knowledgeably about Outdoor Retailer. I worked for them for 15 years and was show director there for 8. So I kind of know that platform pretty well. And it is it's timed the way it is to serve a certain part of the market, which generally I'll call the lifestyle side of the market. So attached to the fashion and apparel industry, Street, where a ton of the critical mass is for building apparel lines, designing product that changes out every 6 months or faster. And so one of the core values of the Big Gear Show is we're decidedly not focused on that. We're really focused on the products that have a longer tail, that have, take longer to bring to market, whether that's a solar battery or an e-bike or a new tent design. Once you build one of those, it's in your line as a company for years, hopefully, a decade or something. It's a real hit. You're not going to change the colors in 6 months and redesign it to sell out and move on to the next, whatever whim the fashion industry has. So it's a very different way to come to market with respect to the product category. So that's one of the big differences. Also, I would say that today's events have to be very nimble. The market needs are changing really quickly. So very large kind of legacy or conventional events have a really hard time pivoting their business model, changing their offer to match the needs of the industry, whether that's the retailer side or the exhibitor side or the many different aspects or what I call the ecosystem of the industry. And you have to have fingers on the pulse on that and be able to act on the dime and even have multiple event plans running simultaneously. So that's really hard for legacy shows. So, that's kind of what I'll say about that. I think the last thing I'll say is that after the pandemic, we've had almost two and a half years of events that have either been canceled, not staged, or staged in an alternative way, like online or virtual. And that has taught the industry, players, brands, retailers, media, that to invest and to follow these other alternative ways of getting products to market. So the challenge of all shows is to come out of that and deliver a value that kind of is new and speaks differently to the traditional showgoer, because frankly they haven't had to do it for 2 years. So the question is, why should they?
Well, there's nothing like getting on a lake and testing out that electric paddleboard yourself. We've been speaking with Kenji Haritunian. He is the director of the Big Gear Show. Kenji, thank you for joining us.
As a nonprofit radio station, KPCW relies on donor support to deliver daily news, information, and entertainment all year long. Twice a year, KPCW asks the community to show their hashtag KPCWLove during their summer and winter pledge drives. Renee Miller, KPCW's general manager, joins us this morning to highlight the 2022 summer pledge drive coming up on August 26th through 25th. Renee, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Allison. Thanks, Doug. Good to be here.
Let's begin with you talking about the expansive scope of KPCW's programming. What is it that the station provides for the community?
Great question. We provide local news. We provide the Mountain Town Sound, which is what we call the eclectic mix of music from classic rock to current hits. We provide excellent public affairs shows. Mountain Money is one of them, Monday through Thursday at 9 a.m. We do BBC News overnight. We do NPR News at the top of every hour. We have some lovely public media shows like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR Saturdays at 9, followed by TED Radio Hour. We bring you Splendid Table from American Public Media on Sundays. They had a great show this past Sunday about catering that was fascinating. We bring you The Time Machine from The Current. The year they focused on Saturday was 1974. I'm a 70s baby. I loved that.
Great. And we also do a lot of outreach and help for the local not-for-profits, which is one of the things I'm super proud of the station for. Tell us about that, the impact. What percent of our airtime goes for not-for-profits?
Ooh, percentage of airtime, that's a good question, Doug, because it is part of the station's mission to support all nonprofits in our community. We give them our megaphone, essentially. We invite them on the local news hour to talk about what they're doing for the community. We just had YSA on this morning, Emily Fisher, talking about their new outreach in Wasatch County after school programs, which was really cool. That's just one example of what we do every day. Leslie Thatcher books these nonprofits for local news hour. They reach out, they tell us if they have something going on that they want our listeners to know. Then our news team follows up and does news reports on what they're doing. Then the nonprofits can get free public service announcements. So at quarter past the hour, our volunteer DJs read public service announcements. They also read them at 45 minutes past the hour. We added that up, just those free announcements alone are about $800,000 worth of free marketing for nonprofits. And then, of course, when nonprofits come in and help us raise money for our pledge drive, like you just heard Diane Bernhardt spot with the Hope Alliance, the Hope Alliance is going to be on. Hang on, I've got the calendar right in front of me.
She said Wednesday.
Stand by. Monday at 3 o'clock is when Hope Alliance is on. If they raise more than $1,000 during their hour, every dollar they raise over that $1,000 goes towards free underwriting. And just in our last summer and winter pledge drives, we awarded over $125,000 in free underwriting to our partner nonprofits. We love giving back. We love that partnership we have with them.
So how many ears do you have listening? You know, and I know it may not just be ears, because the website is absolutely a forum in which people can be able to digest the information and the programming from KPCW. How do you measure that? And do you have an idea of how much maybe, you know, per year I as a listener, you know, would look to contribute as well, as far as, you know, the operations of the organization?
We have about 1,200 donors a year. It costs us $2.1 million a year to run this station. That's the new budget our board just passed that will take effect September 1st. We put together a $2.1 million budget. So who can do the math real quick? We need $2.1 million divided by 1,200 donors. But there are other places we get our money. For example, CPB, Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Last year they gave us $272,000. So that comes from the National Endowment for the Arts grant, which then gives money to the CPB, which then doles out money to all public radio stations. And that is legislated under the 1967 Communications Act. So that's some money that we get from the federal government. The RAP tax, they gave us $118,000 last year. So thank you very much, Summit County RAP tax. KPCW got the largest grant of any nonprofit. And we were so grateful for that because, again, we're like that umbrella organization. We want to help all other nonprofits. So that's an example of where we get some other funds. The Broadcasters Club, right now we have more than 305 members, Doug, and they brought in our last fiscal year, $534,000. So Broadcasters Club alone brings in, 25% of our budget now. And we like to give back to the Broadcasters Club members by throwing really great events throughout the year. We will put together anywhere from 10 to 14 events. And I actually have some good friends in the Broadcasters Club who, they are thrifty, let's say, and they pencil it out, and they're like, how does KPCW make money off of this? And we make money because we get things in kind. Like Deer Valley will donate a ski day. Vail's Epic Promise donates a first tracks to us. So then we give that back to our Broadcasters Club.
Yeah, no, it's been a great source of support for the station. I used to be on the board, and it was something that was introduced about a decade ago, and now it's a really important source of funding, as is the pledge drive. It's really critical. Can you talk about what percent of your budget relies on listener support?
We rely on $300,000 for our pledge drive. Now, that breaks out the Broadcaster Club memberships. So a lot of people renew their Broadcasters Club during a pledge drive. So take Broadcasters Club out of it, we need to raise $300,000 in donations from our pledge drives. So that is, you know, if someone wants to be a recurring donor and donate online and give $10 a month, that would be great. We serve 80,000 people. That's the population of Summit and Wasatch County. And I think I did the math and said, okay, if everyone donated $43 a year who lives in Summit and Wasatch County, we wouldn't have to hold pledge drives. But pledge drives are fun, so I'm not going to take pledge drives off the air.
So next week, as the pledge drive starts, why don't you give us just an overview of what people can expect during kind of the day, as far as how you'll be reaching out?
So we'll kick off Monday morning at 8 a.m. The local news team will be in the DJ booth. We'll be talking about our favorite stories, which, by the way, happy one-year anniversary for the Parleys Canyon wildfire, you guys. That was a year ago today.
And we postponed.
Yeah, and we ended up postponing the pledge drive for a week because people were evacuated. So we'll have the local news team in Monday at 8 o'clock. And then after that, we'll have a whole bunch of nonprofits come in from 8 to noon. And the nonprofits and their sponsors will hit the airwaves and talk about raising money for KPCW. We'll also play some great music in there as well. We'll take a break from noon to 3, and then from 3 to 6, we'll kick back into action again. And this is Monday through Thursday. Speaking of kicking into action, Back Alley Bash this Friday, I have to mention that. 5 to 9, free party, City Park, free music. Bring your own picnic, bring your own cooler. We're going to have a great time.
New location, City Park. You probably heard Renee say City Park, but if you didn't, this has been going on for 30 years, maybe more, but it's a new location, City Park.
Thanks to Cole Sports for sponsoring Back Alley Bash.
Renee, I want to ask, I guess we need to wrap up, actually. So, Renee, always a joy talking to you. We've been speaking to Renee Bodley-Miller. She is KPCW's general manager. Thank you, Renee.
You've been listening to KPCW's Mountain Money. Do you love Mountain Money? Let us know. Leave us a review.